As Unitarian Universalists, we find wisdom and inspiration in many places: Jewish and Christian scriptures and other sacred texts, the arts, science, nature, our own experiences. Our tradition keeps us open to revelation from many sources. Today's wisdom comes from On the Origin of Species by Charles Darwin. These are the first and final paragraphs of the introduction to the work. The first paragraph reads, "When on board HMS Beagle as naturalist, I was much struck with certain facts in the distribution of the inhabitants of South America and in the geological relations of the present to the past inhabitants of that continent. These facts seemed to me to throw some light on the origin of species, that mystery of mysteries, as it has been called by our greatest philosophers. On my return home, it occurred to me that something might perhaps be made out on this question by patiently accumulating and reflecting on all sorts of facts which could possibly have any bearing. After 5 years' work, I allowed myself to speculate on the subject and drew up some short notes. These I enlarged into a sketch of the conclusions, which then seemed to me probable. From that period to the present day, I have steadily pursued the same object. I hope that I may be excused for entering on these personal details, as I give them to show that I have not been hasty in coming to a decision." And the final paragraph from the introduction: "No one ought to feel surprise at much remaining as yet unexplained in regard to the origin of species and varieties, if he makes due allowance for our profound ignorance in regard to the mutual relation of all the beings which live around us. Who can explain why one species ranges widely and is very numerous, and why another allied species has a narrow range and is rare? Yet these relations are of the highest importance, for they determine the present welfare and the future success and modification of every inhabitant of this world. Still less do we know of the mutual relations of the innumerable inhabitants of the world during the many past geological epochs in its history. Although much remains obscure and will long remain obscure, I can entertain no doubt that the view which most naturalists entertain, namely that each species has been independently created, is erroneous. I am fully convinced that species are not immutable, but that those belonging to what are called the same genera are lineal descendants of some other and generally extinct species. Furthermore, I am convinced that natural selection has been the main, but not exclusive, means of modification."
Can you hear me? Okay. This is a sermon that Reverend Karen wrote some while ago, about 10 years ago, actually. And it begins with a story of her, a personal story of hers. And when I read it, the I is actually her, not me. One fine spring day back in 2001, I was out hiking in the mountains of eastern Kentucky. It wasn't a hike for fun. I was on the job inspecting a site for which a permit application for surface mining had been filed. I was looking for potential habitat or for threatened or endangered species, and my companion for this site visit was a mining engineer named Denham. Denham and I had worked together before, and despite the obvious differences in world views between a Kentucky-born conservative coal mining engineer and a Yankee Unitarian ecologist, we got along pretty well. He was around my age and more progressive in his views on coal mining, and the environment than many of the old school engineers I'd worked with. Nevertheless, I was pretty surprised when during the course of the day he asked me the big question. "So, Karen, you're a biologist. What do you think of this evolution thing?" I told him that I thought the idea of natural selection was a pretty good way to explain the variety of life and how it all fits together. He replied that the idea made sense for the lower life forms, but he couldn't believe it extended to us humans. If we weren't put on the earth as we were by God, then there didn't seem to be much of a point of our lives. A press release of January 17, 2008, by the Institute for Humanist Studies said recent Gallup polls show that 43% of Americans reject the theory of evolution and instead believe God created human beings pretty much in the present form at one time within the last 10,000 years. November the 24th, that's yesterday, is Evolution Day. And there's a reference here if you'd like to see it. February 12th marks the, 2008, the 199th anniversary of Charles Darwin's birth. And the 149th anniversary of the 1859 publication of Darwin's The Origin of the Species, which presented the scientific theory that populations evolve over generations through natural selection. The Darwin Day celebration is a project of the Institute for Humanist Studies, which is an international organization, non-profit, that promotes reason and humanity. They have sponsored hundreds of events in churches and schools across the nation, promoting the idea that evolution as a religion and religion are not mutually exclusive, and that evolution includes us. We all know that Darwin was the man who came up with the theory of how evolution works. Natural selection is based on the idea that there are slight variations among the individuals within any given species, and that these variations give rise to adaptations that can, over generations, create individuals that are different from the original. If the adaptation is beneficial, it gives the individuals that's different a better chance of survival in its current environment than the original. It has a better chance of producing offspring, which have a better chance of having the same adaptation, and so a better chance of survival, and so on. A new species has evolved, and the original version, again, over generations, may die out or become extinct or find another place to live where this particular adaptation makes it a better candidate for survival. This is one of the sticking points between creationists and those who support the theory of evolution. A creationist will say that a woodpecker, for example, is so well suited for its life among the trees, with its strong beak, long probing tongue, stiff tail, short legs, and long curving toes, that it was designed for this particular lifestyle and placed into the forest as both were created. A believer in the theory of evolution will say that the woodpecker is descended from other birds who had these adaptations and passed them along to their offspring and so began to be able to live among the trees. But this wasn't an idea that Darwin just pulled out of his imagination. Quite the opposite, in fact. He had to wrestle with it for years after making those observations during his voyage. he had to reconcile with what he saw with his creationist beliefs. He saw the birds in the Galapagos Islands that we most often associate with his theories, finches on each island that look so similar but not quite the same. The iguanas on the island were the same way. He found different colours of the same creature on each island, and each population ate different things. He found fossils of huge animals on the coast of South America, animals that no longer lived but looked similar to some that did. He had debated at length with himself why they looked so like living creatures but not quite, and why hadn't they been picked up by Noah's Ark? He found living animals and fossil remains, where the structure of the specimens were the same, such as armadillos with their curved segmented shells, but in sizes ranging from under a foot long to over 20 feet long, depending on their habitat. He saw living rheas and guanacos, as well as their fossilized remains, and noted that represented a variety of sizes and colours. They were similar enough to be classified as rheas and guanacos, but each new group he encountered had something unique that made them just a bit different. So he began to note the usefulness of these differences to the animals in terms of their success at defending their territory, obtaining food and mates. And he didn't just study plants and animals. He found a bed of seashells at 12,000 feet in the Andes, above fossilized pine trees with marine rocks. He deduced that the trees had been carried under the ocean and later been raised high on the mountains. But this had to be an incredible motion, and if it had occurred at the rate of modern geological changes, the Earth had to be older than he believed. If the Earth had been created just as it was only 10,000 years ago, how did these seashells get way up there? He later visited Concepcion, where there had been a major earthquake, and that had raised the land surface by several feet, and thought again about what he'd seen in the Andes. He began to put it all together during the year after the end of the Beagle voyage. It started with those Galapagos finches, which he'd collected specimens of, but he hadn't labelled which birds came from which island, because he had assumed that they were all the same species. As he sorted his specimens, he began to realise that they actually varied from island to island, that each island actually had its own distinct species. He found it very easy to imagine that all those birds had evolved from a common ancestor. Those living and fossilised rheas show the same kind of geographic variation. It was observations that lied this led Darwin to believe that species could change. But why would they? Remember, Darwin's framework, his worldview, the idea that everything had been created at once and hadn't changed since then, was almost universally accepted. So for what reason would species change over time? These words are from Darwin's autobiography. In October 1838, that is 15 months after I had begun my systematic inquiry, I happened to read for amusement Malthus on Population, and being well prepared to appreciate the struggle for existence which everywhere goes on from long-continued observation of the habits of animals and plants, it at once struck me that under these circumstances, favorable variations would tend to be preserved and unfavorable ones to be destroyed. The result would be formization of a new species. In Karen's words, wow, talk about an epiphany. This was Darwin's other journey to make sense of the things he was observing within the framework of the accepted belief that all living things were placed onto this earth in the exact form that they exist today. He tried, oh how he tried, to make what he was seeing and learning fit into that framework. He'd be chosen over some other naturalists to go on the Beagle voyage because he had been studying to be a clergyman. He was more likely than some others might have been to uphold the biblical view of the creation. But during the journey, after the voyage, he followed his reason and his gut, stepped out of the box of current understanding and called it like he saw it. As Ozzie said, some will become smart. They will know who they are and why they exist. They will understand everything that is, and they will celebrate everything they understand. Reflecting on the amazing journeys of Darwin led me, that's Karen, that is, down the path of thinking about another amazing journey, one that has grown out of his ideas. For all the heart of the evolution lies the idea that we are born of a set of one-celled ancestors swimming in that primordial soup of the primitive earth. And those ancestors were born out of the elements around them, coming together to form life. And those elements, they were born of nothing less than the stars themselves. Look beyond the origin to the species, to the origin of life, and allow that the realization that you and I and everything and everyone around you were born of the stars. Let that sink in. This amazing journey of our evolution is far longer than the 40,000 years since the emergence of modern Homo sapiens. It's longer than the 2.6 million years since the development of the first humanoid-type species. It's longer than the 438 million years since Ozzy and his or her cousins started developing the appendages that eventually differentiated into arms and legs. It's longer than the 700 million years since the first multicellular life form. It's even longer than the 4 billion years since the first... Since the first one-cell bacteria emerged in the waters of our young planet. This universe is, it says here 15 billion. We have more experts on the field than that here. 13.7, there you go. Any advance on 13.7? Sold. Okay. As the elements and particles that make up our bodies and everything around us. For out of the primordial flaring forth of unimaginable energy, out of the infinite mystery that some people call the Big Bang, which is more than a TV program, and others call the Great Radiance, was born all of the hydrogen that ever was and ever shall be. I mean, the burning masses of stars that lived and died before our sun was born, every single atom that exists in the universe today was created. And now there's us. a species of being capable of reflecting back on our own creation and evolution and hungering to do so, a conscious, aware presence on our living earth, looking up into the heavens and wondering in our souls, looking at our own presence among the stars with awesome knowledge that they are our ancestors. We have evolved to the point that we can know and marvel at this own story, of our own story. What an amazing journey from darkness into light, from stillness into life, from space to water to land, from one-celled to many-celled, to differentiating to conscious. And what a wondrous expression of the interconnected web. With his keen observations, his ability to reason, and the courage to formulate and articulate a theory that went against all the current dogma, Charles Darwin gave us a previously unimaginable understanding of our human roots and a connection with all living things on this earth. And in doing so, he gave us the tools to delve even deeper, to question other truths, to discover other truths. We've learned to apply these tools on our quest towards an even wider understanding of our origins, to the level of a connection with the entire universe. And we have Charles Darwin to thank for it.